Sher and Bagara, it's remembering them I am right enough," said the other cab driver without hesitation, even before I had fully described a frail girl in a citrine-hued bell skirt and her two dowager chaperones. My driver had, without much difficulty, located Paddy Murphy in a stable yard of the Serpentine Mews, seated upon a bale of straw with a mug of ale in hand, while he offered the other cabbies a look for a penny at some mysterious marvel he kept in a pasteboard box. This he had put away hastily upon my arrival, standing up and tugging his cap. Now, clutching the shilling I had handed him, Paddy Murphy spoke on with true Irish loquacity. "If only because the two old battle-axes, beg pardon, m'lady, the matron ladies, grudged me the fare they did, and me squaring them hither and yon all the livelong afternoon."
"Hither and yon where, exactly?"
"To be sure, if there's a linen draper's shop in London where we dinna go, I dinna know of it. Up one street and down the next. It was looking in the shop windows they were, walking, or one of the grand ladies walking, and the other in the cab with that poor creature of a girl at their beck and call. Now and again they'd take her inside a mercer's or some such, and I was to wait, blocking traffic, with the coach drivers cursing me eyes and me ancestors, begging your ladyship's pardon. And then we was to stop for a package, blocking traffic some more, or wait for an order to be filled, and the constables roaring at me and threatening me license, and all the while I'm counting on the fare."
While the other cab driver stood at my elbow as if he considered himself my escort and guardian, I listened with interest, but with increasing impatience, well concealed, I hope, for it is futile to attempt to hurry an Irishman in the telling of a tale. But I wanted to know, where did Cecily Alastair ultimately go?
"Rather give it up entirely than ever go through such a rigmarole again," Paddy Murphy was saying. "But it couldn't be helped, for the poor wee colleen, she could barely walk, so it seemed, and far be it from me to judge me betters, but it was none too kind to her those grand ladies was, if I do say it, who shouldn't be noticing."
"But I am very glad you did notice," I told him, discreetly displaying financial proof of my approval in my gloved hand, a pound note that would be his if he spoke on satisfactorily. "Please continue. Where did you take them, ultimately?" I quite wanted to know where Ladies Aquila and Otelia were hiding Cecily. "Are they staying at one of the hotels?"
"Why, no, my lady. I took them ladies and all their packages to a place called Inglethorpe,"
Viscountess Otelia's humble abode. My heart sank.
"The grandson, too, that is," added my rosy-faced informant. "But before that, the little one, the wee lassie, why, they dropped her off at a boot."
"A what?"
"Aye, that were the peculiarest part of the whole peculiar business. They had me stop at a boot along the Thames, and two watermen in flat hats, they took the girl."
"A boat," I belatedly understood as I demanded. "Took her where?"
"Why, in the boot, out on the river, my lady. I didn't see any more."
I wanted to stamp my foot, roll my eyes, burst out crying, confound and blast everything. This was the last straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. The last straw at which a similarly proverbial drowning person might grasp, unwilling to let even the most slender of hopes drift by. Finding myself willing to play the latter desperate role, "Show me where," I demanded of the Irish cab driver, "where, exactly, you left her. Take me there." Chapter the 15th. Half an hour later, I stood at the foot of a squalid little pier on the Thames, my nose wrinkled against stench, looking for Cecily Alastair. Here? It was a place even more wretched than the bleak streets where I had last found her. Down along the black water swarmed filthy beggar children, mudlarks scavenging bits of bone, wood, or metal from the muck. Tattooed men swaggered in and out of hulking brick buildings marked Trawlers Limited, or Siam Burma Orient Line, or launches for hire. Steamships and tall-masted sailing ships and innumerable smaller vessels crowded the straitened river, whilst a hulking mechanism called a dredger loomed over everything, giving forth a deep roar punctuated by the curses of sailors, the shrieks of mudlarks, and the yawps of seagulls wheeling overhead. Trying to take it all in, I felt my heart sink. Still grasping at straws, I asked the half-drunken cabman beside me, "Did you actually see her being rowed away by watermen?"
"Sure and I did."
And surely they had taken her to a houseboat or some such lodging, which, unlike a hotel, could move about, changing location from day to day. Fiendishly clever. Nearly impossible to discover. Nevertheless, I mumbled, "Which way did they go?" He pointed upstream. I glanced in that direction, sighed, and started to turn away, utterly defeated. But something white-flecked caught my eye. Straightening, I looked again, peering at a gaggle of brown gingham in the distance. No longer lethargic and mumbling, quite the opposite, staring like a bird dog on point, I exclaimed, "Is there an orphanage hereabouts?" He answered in the affirmative, indicating a dull green mansard roof looming perhaps a block away. Instantly, the noisiest possible seagull flock of memory, suspicion, and conjecture whirled into my head, all my thoughts yelling at once. Little girls with shorn heads following the ha-ha man. What the deuce was his name? Baron Dagobert Maganza, in his sister-in-law's mansion. Why not his own home? Perhaps because he did not want it known who he really was? But why had he been consorting with orphans at all? He seemed hardly the charitable type. And why at such a ticklish time, when he was holding his well-to-do niece captive to force her to marry his son? Arrangements had been made to use some quite secluded chapel. Oh. Oh, my goodness! Did orphanages have chapels? It seemed probable that they did, but I did not know for sure, and I should have investigated the matter thoroughly, of course, for it might have been the merest coincidence that there was an orphanage near this particular pier on the Thames. Moreover, the orphans I had seen at Inglethorpe might have come from a different institution altogether. Their presence might have signified nothing, etc. Yet, as my brother Sherlock would have said, it was suggestive, was it not? A chance offered itself, and there was no time for research and hesitation. The unfortunate Lady Cecily was to be forcibly wed tomorrow morning. Desperate measures were called for. 2 hours later, walking towards the Witherspoon home for waifs and strays, I tried to see something to indicate the presence of a chapel, a stained glass window, for instance. But I observed only the upper part of an exceedingly plain three-story stone and plaster edifice surrounded by a tall wooden fence with its vertical planks so close set one could not even peep through the cracks. Most unattractive, that barrier, and most uncompromising. I found it easy enough at that point to look as if I were about to weep, this being exactly the effect I desired. I was got up as a waif. A rather tall waif, but a waif nevertheless. In order to present a stick-thin, indeed cadaverous figure, I had put aside all my improvers, regulators, and enhancers. No small decision, as along with them I put aside my defensive armour, corset and dagger, and most of my usual supplies. I carried with me only a few carefully selected items in my pockets. These did not include food, and there had been no time to eat. My stomach yowled with hunger, and I felt a bit faint. Well, so much the better for the impression I needed to make. With a combination of vinegar and soap, I had rendered my skin pasty and blistered, and a touch of lampblack made my eyes appear haggard, my cheeks hollow. My own hair, allowed to tangle down my back, was quite ugly enough for any ragamuffin, especially after I had rubbed it and myself with coal ash. I wore the midden-picker's exceedingly humble and dirty clothing, hanging far too large upon my bony shoulders and chest, and I had even gone so far as to tear some rips in the cloth. My feet I wrapped with rags. On my head, indeed almost covering my eyes, I had placed a bowler hat rescued from the street, well squashed by horses' feet and carriage wheels. As a pauper girl will use any such item to keep her head warm and covered, the effect was, I thought, most salubrious, as was my hesitation. Anyone watching would see a waif trying to gather courage to venture into the fenced and forbidding unknown, not quite decided to give up her starveling freedom for the sake of food, a shorn head, and domestic servitude. They could not possibly know that the vacillating waif was actually an aspiring Purditorian, not quite decided whether she really needed to risk contacting her brother. Indeed, after pacing the area of the orphanage a while, making sure there was only one way to get in or out, I retreated. But only for a brief period of time, during which I penciled a note, expressing much greater certainty than I actually felt, as follows. Sherlock, shortly prior to nuptial travesty, C.A. will attempt to exit Witherspoon Orphanage, 472 Huxtable Lane, with Pink Fan. Meet her at gate. I leave it to you to assist her from there. E.H.